Catherine, I want to thank you for joining me here in Montana. I think that you're a very important person to the future of this world. I think that you have spent a tremendous amount of time, paid a lot of dues, as the expression goes.
Invested a lot of dues.
To develop some very critical ideas, and one might say a kind of a blueprint for a new investment model for the planet, and what that could potentially mean for us and our living networks. So I want to take the time to look at what I think are some critical concepts in your world, in this blueprint, and I appreciate your indulgence.
I'm delighted to do it. Okay, let's go.
Okay. Let's start with the word Solari. Why the word Solari?
In the science fiction book Dune, Solari is the intergalactic currency. And the notion for me of an intergalactic currency is a financial tool that can permit the sharing of intelligence and transactions, products, and services between very diverse people. Not just each person is different and special in a very diverse world, but between remarkably different cultures with different values, different goals, different learning metabolisms. And so the idea is, how can very diverse people and very diverse worlds share goods and services and share intelligence in a way that's mutually energizing?
You've used the word harmonize.
Harmonize, right.
For that process.
Right.
So in a way, good, fair business practices based on mutually respected covenants and just mutual respect can build a world where peace is possible. And I think also, don't you have a basic belief that peace isn't possible unless that kind of world is created?
Right. I feel without certain financial tools and certain kinds of markets that you cannot build enough understanding and cooperation for peace. When I was trying to decide on the use of the word Solari, I was on the internet and I found a reference to Solari being from the Greek, meaning to reduce anxiety through illumination. Now, I've never been able to find that reference since, but that's what great currencies do. They reduce anxiety through illumination. And that is an essential step in reducing the risk you need to move towards a world of peace.
We're going to get into some of these concepts, reducing risk, money as part of a living network, money as being an agency for intelligence.
Money is something that's alive.
So we're going to explore some of these. But in a way, you've also, in the process of describing the word Solari, you've also defined the fundamental goal, this harmonization.
Right. Harmonization, but part of it is what we're looking for is an investment model that will embrace complexity and diversity in a world where every person is different and where the harmonization of those differences creates far more wealth than a centralized world that shrinks diversity.
So this is also an invitation, isn't it?
Right. It's an invitation to not be afraid of complexity and to not need centralization to facilitate the transactional flow and the coordination we need to be in cahoots with each other and not to be at war.
So it's an invitation not only for the folks that think of themselves perhaps as just ordinary folks with not much financial sophistication, but also the elites too, right?
Right. It's how do both groups, or how do all those different groups share intelligence in a way that is mutually energizing? How do groups with very high technology and tremendous amounts of access to information share intelligence with groups that have, say, a closer connection to the earth in a way that's mutually energizing for both of them? And I get back to the word harmonization. It's a good one because, you know, in music, you can have an alto and a bass. You can have a soprano and a tenor. They can give each other energy if they harmonize.
And perhaps this even connects to the fact that I think our worldview is coming to understand in the physical sciences how much of the foundations of our universe is connected to vibrations, vibrational energy,
right.
And you might say the harmonization of those vibrations.
Right.
You went to Wharton.
Right.
You've been on Wall Street.
Right.
With Dylan Reed, which has produced folks like Dylan, who was Secretary of the Treasury.
Right.
Forrestal, who was a Secretary of the Navy and then also Secretary of Defense, right?
Then War, but we now call it Defense.
Also Mr. Brady, who was the chairman at the time you were there, who became another Secretary of the
Secretary
Treasury.
Secretary of the Treasury, right.
You also were in the Bush administration.
As Assistant Secretary of Housing.
And FHA Commissioner.
Right.
You also were an advisor, basically, for those same organizations, right, for the Clinton administration.
Right.
And then you went on to Wall Street to develop a very innovative firm that was prototyping a lot of new business models.
Basically, I came out of the Bush administration and said, we need a new investment model for the planet. And we need an investment model where wealth, financial wealth and living wealth, which is the source of financial wealth ultimately, give each other energy, are mutually supportive. I discovered new technology when I was in the Bush administration, and I saw two things. One is this technology gave us the opportunity to create much higher learning metabolisms, sufficient so that, for example, the American people could so increase our productivity, could so increase learning metabolisms and the sharing of intelligence worldwide that we really could become a sustainable culture. The other thing I saw is the way that new technology was being used by certain parties literally to achieve a control and centralization, which was absolutely terrifying to me. So many people and so much money is stuck inside the old system. You know, it's almost like they're on the Titanic. It's sinking, but they have no place to go. So the question was, how can we understand what an investment model that aligns the health of living systems, whether it's the environment or people, with financial capital, and do it in a way that creates far more wealth in a diversified, much more open model. So how could we go to the light, so to speak, with our money in a way that could also address all the different problems that the centralization model was addressing through fear? And so what we did was we started a company and prototype. We did about $12 billion of transactions, and the question was, what would the optimal investment model look like for a person, a family, a community, and a company, an enterprise? And then networks, you know, networks of communities, networks of small businesses. What did this look like as a living network, both, you know, in a place or worldwide? And we prototyped that. We also did about $500 billion of portfolio strategy with the lead financial advisor for the Federal Housing Administration. And in that context, had to do the $500 billion. But one of the reasons we wanted that assignment is we wanted to be able to build databases and tools that could simulate the whole economy, both in the United States and globally. So while we're doing $500 billion of portfolio strategies and $12 billion of transactions, which is the best flow of data that you can have, you know, when you look at real deals, we were also simulating and trying to do portfolio strategy on a much bigger scale. For example, in 1997, I remember I had somebody prototype what would happen if we implemented the Solari model, including allowing venture funds to finance small business in a much more liquid way. Our analysis showed that the float of liquid equity increased a multiple of six times. So one of the things I saw as a result of that is if you understand how deeply depressed the economy is from this kind of centralized control and manipulation, you realize the opportunity of what happens if real market forces were truly unleashed.
So your world is truly a world of abundance, not scarcity.
Yes. Yeah. There's no other way to get to peace without abundance.
But it's still a way that's respectful of the natural wealth. In fact, it's in harmony with creating natural wealth.
Right. Well, you can't have abundance unless you are in harmony. If you destroy the source of wealth, you can't build wealth. So we're in the funny situation of having an economy that shrinks wealth. It shrinks total wealth as it consolidates it into the hands of the few, which ultimately means if you keep doing that, what you have to do is you have to depopulate in the extreme.
That's your negative return on investment economy, and you also refer to it as the tapeworm economy.
Right, and it's funny. I was recently asked on a radio show, what's the worst-case scenario? And what's the best case scenario? And I said, the best case scenario is we have a financial meltdown and productivity matters again. And we're forced to organize on a more sustainable basis. We can't keep a very non-sustainable lifestyle afloat with debt. And I said the worst case is if the people centralizing the economy can use their technology and their tools to literally manipulate the markets and manipulate the economy in a situation where the financial system doesn't melt down, life melts down.
And that's what you call a slow burn.
I call that the slow burn. And the challenge of the slow burn is if you are an authentic person, whether you're an authentic small business person, you're an authentic environmentalist, you've got a problem because the non-sustainable system is offering most people a cash flow sufficient to cover their overhead. And so how do the productive people offer a way out that's ethical, because we're competing with all the debt on the planet and all the printed money on the planet?
Would you say that Solari is really an extension of your work at Hamilton to a large extent?
Hamilton was created to prototype and figure this out. You know, looking at the technology and looking how things work now, my intuition is this. And then you would go do a series of transactions or portfolio strategy, and then you would learn a lot more about how money works in places. A lot of this was just looking at how money really works in places and looking at hard data of what people are really doing with their money. And you would look at that and you would say, okay, now, well, why is that? When I first read Sheldrake's books on morphogenic fields, I said, voila, you know, here's a scientific theory or hypothesis, it's not proven, that fits tremendously with what I'm seeing in the numbers of how people are really behaving when you look at their transactions. It's fascinating. What Sheldrake's theory of morphogenic field says is that essentially we share knowledge. Our bodies are processors as opposed to storers of databases. And we share knowledge together in fields, just like a gravity field is an invisible field. A morphogenic field is a field of knowledge where literally, you know, I would say, you know, we have shared databases. And a lot of our financial transactions and a lot of markets are organized where we share common knowledge and ideas about how things should work or do work.
But it also has to do with the fact that you could be prototyping, finding out something here, and somebody somewhere else in a very isolated situation basically is enlightened by that process.
Right. One of the things what Sheldrake addresses is the 100 monkey syndrome, and the 100 monkey syndrome is where talks about what does it take for an adaptation to take hold and move to volume in a system. And so we have the story of six monkeys changing their behavior and how they wash a banana, or washing a banana before they eat a banana. And then all of a sudden, after the six sort of work it out, and it works for them, all of a sudden monkeys on different islands are doing it. And it relates to what I call the non-local transfer of knowledge, where you get these sudden shifts of knowledge. My career on Wall Street was one of doing a series of transactions that people didn't think were possible. And if you looked at what made them possible, it was a matter of getting the first six monkeys to work out the issues and the knowledge sufficient that it could be trusted, and then the whole field could adopt it. And so that's, entrepreneurs will sometimes talk about things going up the S-curve. There's a marvelous book recently called The Tipping Point, where, you know, something new starts, everybody kind of swarms over it, fights over it, whatever. They work it all out, and it has integrity for all the different groups, and suddenly, ba-boom, it's everywhere because all those early adapters kind of worked it out and figured it out.
So part of it is kind of enlisting or educating, illuminating enough so that a critical mass gets it, acts on it, and then that... And that causes the tipping.
Gets it, but reinvents it for the level of complexity that it needs to move. Anytime I've tried to start a new market, I'll invent something, and then I'll circulate it. And as I circulate it, what I discover is that it's too crude. It's not thoughtful for the person in the servicing department. It's not thoughtful for the person who's dealing, you know, the bank depository stuff. It's not, you know, so it circulates. When we started Hamilton and we were doing these huge loan sales, we would do a term sheet that was very, you know, detailed and complicated on how to do a $1 billion loan sale. And then we would ship it around to 80 different field offices and division offices, and they would basically destroy it. They would chew it apart. They would, You know, and on the first deal, we ended up with a 2,000-page design book that reflected the intelligence of literally hundreds and hundreds of people sorting through the different options and issues. And when that deal went, it went like a hot knife through butter, because every person touched or affected within the ecosystem or within certain parts of the ecosystem had been given tremendous input. And so it had been worked out to a sufficient level of complexity, both of knowledge and operations, that it was trustworthy to all these different groups, and then it could go. The six monkeys had worked out the details, and then the other 94 said, well, it'll work for me because I know they've worked out this part of this part.
So it's very much an interactive process.
Right.
It's very much a creative process.
Right.
But it also requires folks to make an investment of their time and energy. And you keep telling folks, make those investments in things that will give you energy.
Right. Because what we're really talking about is how do we invent a new world together? Whenever you invest 100 hours in inventing a new world, you never know where your return's going to come back from, but it always comes back. You may spend, 10 hours doing 10 different things, and 9 of them turn out to be stupid, but you learn and the other has a fantastic return, and then you get to the next thing. It's a learning process. It's a learning journey. It's never over. And so if you just understand that the return will come, you just never know from what or where.
Some people would call that an attitude of faith, but I guess it's confidence that the field exists and that it operates.
Right. The field exists, it operates, and we have many different ways of expressing these ideas. A lot of people use the word faith. It's funny, one day I was with a partner, a wonderful partner I had named Ozzy, and suddenly I was looking at Ozzy and I realized, Ozzy grew up on an island. And at Dylan Reed and at Hamlet, in all the places I've ever been, a lot of my favorite partners had grown up on an island. So I said to him, Ozzy, how come I always have so many partners who grew up on an island? And he looked at me and he said, that's because people who grow up on islands can see the world whole. And they can see that their behavior helps impact what's created, and that the best and most effective way to get the world they want is to simply be the world they want. And so by being it, they attract it. By being it and attracting it, withdrawing it from the world they don't want, they literally can create it. And so a person who grows up on an island feels much more powerful to be part of creating the whole.
But it's also a question of they have a smaller world that they can get their arms around, right?
Right, but all these people had come to the United States and were operating in a culture that generally does not see their world whole, feels it's overwhelming, it's too big. Many of us are specialized, so we understand healthcare, but we don't understand sort of an integrated picture of the whole. They continued to operate like that and were enormously successful as a result.
Because they had a sense of power from their upbringing?
They believed that they had the power to invent their world. And the other thing is they could see the United States and look at it as just a big island. So, for example, you'll see somebody who's in a rural community. People in the United States who live in rural communities, in my experience, have a much better understanding of where their water comes from, how the emergency services work, where the sheriffs come from. And literally, because they understand the details of how one place works as an ecosystem and the component parts, they can extrapolate, oh, well, the United States is just a big town. And so they're much better at kind of seeing the whole than people who've grown up in the cities.
By the same token, there's a very important theme in the Solari investment model about the significance of communities, about going local, about developing these local networks.
Right.
Is that basically the same reasoning, that we can get our hands around it? It gives us power.
Well, because there's an opportunity. I mean, there's so much opportunity. All the things you don't like about this planet break down to your family and neighborhood. So, 6 billion people behaving in a certain way get a certain result, and 6 billion people behaving in a different way get a different result. But the building block of that is your place, is your neighborhood. So, if it's going on in your neighborhood, it's going on in the whole. If it's going on in the whole, it's probably going on in your neighborhood. If we can't end the corruption one neighborhood at a time, then you certainly can't end it from Washington. One of the reasons that place is so important is that our political jurisdictions work pretty much by place worldwide. But in America, much of our economy is basically controlled and funded through the federal government budget. You know, it's funny, I sometimes say when I look at the federal budget as it translates down to state, local economies, that the Soviet Union won the war because we have a very centrally controlled economy. And if you look at the political jurisdictions that we use to vote for political representation, we don't have financial information on our tax money and the expenditure of our governmental resources and liabilities for which we're liable, contiguous to the jurisdictions for which we vote for political representation. Now, if you're the congressman or the mayor from a particular area, and I have no clue how the money works, then you can say whatever you want, and I'll go, oh, that's very nice. I'll never forget when Kelly O'Meara had written a wonderful article about DynCorp. DynCorp is a big defense contractor. DynCorp employees engaging in sex slave trafficking. And our congressman at the time was Ed Bryant. I gave this article to somebody, and she said, I can't fathom that Ed Bryant, who, from what everybody says, is a pretty good guy, I can't fathom that Ed Bryant would know that this is happening and not do anything. Well, if they had the numbers on how the federal government money worked in Hardeman County and all the other counties around them, and they'd had that information every time they voted for their congressman over the last 30 years, I dare say they would understand why Bryant might not do anything.
And that's part of why you had a little trouble with Hamilton, wasn't it? You were illuminating things a little bit too well on a local level.
Yeah, and I think there were a couple of problems with place-based transparency at the time. There are different ways to describe this, Harry, but I think we have a society, and I describe this as multiple personality disorder, where we believe we're one thing, but if you look at the money, we're doing another. I mean, we say we're a democracy, but if you look at the money, we're not. So when you illuminate that money, you upset a whole bunch of folks, and you upset a whole bunch of folks who are going to have to change. For example, if you looked at the HUD budget, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, we had a tremendous amount of very well-intended, lovely, gracious, charming, not-for-profit groups that wanted to help people. But if you look at their productivity and the productivity of the system they were part of, it wasn't productive. It had a negative return on investment. Anyway, I brought this presentation on our whole model of investing in developing data servicing small businesses and neighborhoods and really a fantastic opportunity. And after the presentation was over, we had about 35 of the top foundations there. When we turned on the lights after showing our movie about the whole investment we were making, everybody was depressed. And I thought, we're going to end poverty. How could why would anybody be depressed? And the next morning, the head of low-income housing for Fannie Mae sat down to me, and he said, your presentation was the most depressing thing I've ever heard. And I said, Barry, why? I thought you'd be thrilled about this. And he said, what you're saying is that I'm not needed, and my whole career has been a waste. And I said, well, Barry, do you want to end poverty or grow it? Anyway, but you had a group of not-for-profits and all these lovely people who wanted to help, who really were in a system that wasn't productive, but they didn't see a way out. And so when you illuminated all of this stuff, you had a real problem. And then, of course, there was narcotics trafficking, which I've written a lot about. I believe now, Harry, what the biggest problem was is that we had significant discrepancies between the amount of securities outstanding on the part of the U.S. Treasury and the agencies that issue mortgage-backed securities like Ginnie Mae and what was on the books. So my guess is you had significant securities fraud with government securities and that the financial system was dependent on that not getting illuminated. And, of course, if you do what we were doing, which is you bring place-based transparency, then you're comparing the amount of outstanding securities with what's on the government books with the number of houses on any street. And conforming those numbers can illuminate some of those discrepancies, which have now come out. We've now seen in the Financial Times recently, the Financial Times has said that foreign accounts say that America owes them, I think the number is $2.4 trillion more than we say we owe.
The fact of the matter is that you are among a group of people that wanted to see better accountability, help pass laws requiring audited financial statements, and basically that law has been ignored.
Right. There was a group of us in the Bush administration, and it started with me and my team at HUD. We persuaded OMB to get audited financial statements and actuarial statements for the credit programs at HUD for Federal Housing Administration, and then the whole agency, and got that law passed. And after that process, and this is, again, of the six monkeys kind of working it through and trying on HUD and figuring it out, OMB said, this is a great thing. We've got to do this government-wide. And so a law was passed that required the federal government, it's been amended several times, it requires what's called the covered agencies to have chief financial officers and produce audited financial statements. And what has happened as a result of that starting in 1995 is what's come out is, again and again, that the government has refused to comply. Now, why is that important? Getting back to the building the new, I used to have a wonderful deputy at HUD who used to say, in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of the new. And what he meant by that, it's the same idea that the Buddhists say when they say the lotus blossom comes out of the mud. In other words, you can't bring down the old financial system and then bring up the new one like they're totally separate things. You have to get in the muck and mire of the old one and start to invent new things. Or another metaphor to use is when you're on the Titanic, before you jump overboard, get a hold of some wood and some flotsam and some stuff.
Some lifeboats, eh?
Right, some lifeboats, but some stuff to start building your ark with, okay? Because it's not, you know, one all goes away and a whole new one starts. You start being in the flow of what you're doing, and you start incrementally building from there with what you've got.
So, to a large extent now, this new investment model for the world, based on Solari circles, Solari investment funds, other things we'll talk about, is a transition mechanism. It's a sequencing.
Right.
And now you talk about the dirty tricks and how the dirty tricks got you at Hamilton. Is Solari, this new investment model, and this new approach, more dirty trick proof? And to what extent have dirty tricks basically inspired you to come up with a little different twist?
I was very focused on the need for business people in a place to find a way to access capital to fund small business equity and to make that more liquid than it is now, which means more transferable. So I was very focused on sort of the business, the small business folks and that process. And what the dirty tricks helped me understand was what we really need to do as a building block is we need to help individuals take as many actions as they can individually. It's a process that we at Solari call coming clean. So each person has to look at their own time and their own money and say, how can I start to shift my attention, my time, my money off of the Titanic and onto, you know, building arcs? And I know in the last year, you know, we have, including with your help, created 18 audio seminars that takes your bank deposits or takes different aspects of your money or your life and helps each individual say, okay, how can I start to come clean? How can I get my money to come clean? So part of it was stepping back and saying, look, you know, this isn't just a matter of getting small businesses to switch things. We really need this to come from individuals bottom up. That's number one. Number two, as each of us do that, we have the power to shift our sphere of influence out by organizing. I know you always hear me telling people that I always say, don't worry if there is a conspiracy, if you're not in one, you need to start one. So, and we have a notion of doing circles, which is you get together with people you really trust. And then you start to help each other understand all your money. So whether it's your banking flows, whether it's your purchases, whether it's your debt, whether it's your investments, all the different money in your life. And then if you're interested to start to look at the money in your place around you and say, okay, now how can we start to shift and our time and money and do it in a way that helps shift time and money off the Titanic and onto the arcs, but in a way that makes our arcs stronger and float. So you're looking to save time, you're looking to save money, you're looking to make money, not in a selfish way, but in an opportunistic way to kind of withdraw resources from the centralizing economy and get them into the new. Put your oxygen mask on first. then you help, you know, the kid next to you. But it's kind of that idea, put your own oxygen mask on next, because the more oxygen you get, the more you can invest.
So we've looked at why the word Soleri, the fundamental goal of Soleri, which is harmonization through financial harmonization, you might say, harmonization of a world, diverse world, the role of illumination, and now we're getting to this theme of decentralization, how important it is, and of course a key concept through all of your tapes, and to the need for going local, and decentralization is this idea of equity and the true cost of capital. Tell us about equity.
If you look at a history of the last 50 years and you look at the process by which more and more resources have gone into fewer and fewer corporations, what you're watching is a competition between the small and the large. And the large is winning for a variety of reasons. The most important one from a financial standpoint is cost of capital. So, for example, let's look at my old neighborhood where I grew up in Philadelphia. You had hundreds of thriving small businesses when I was a child. Now, when you go back, you don't have a lot of thriving small businesses, and you have a lot of big corporations who have a big market share in that place. How did that happen? Well, if you also walk around that neighborhood, and you look at all the different institutions, whether it's the university, the churches, the you know, everybody who's got their 401k or their different retirement plans, what you see is everyone in that community is investing their retirement savings or their pools of capitals in securities of large corporations. Let's say if they sell a dollar of goods and they have 10 cents of profits, their publicly traded stock has a multiple of, say, 10, 20, or 30 times.
Times earnings.
Times earnings. So if I make a dime and my multiple's 10 times earnings, my equity value from that sale is a dollar.
My stock goes up by a buck.
My stock goes up by a buck. Now, small business has traditionally not issued stock. The stock has been held privately. And as the more and more capital flows into the publicly traded stocks and corporations can access that capital and small businesses can't, the corporations have a much lower cost of capital.
The big get bigger.
The big get bigger.
But isn't that the kind of a rule of law? And people would argue, hey, I mean, a rule of evolution, you might say, in the world. People would say, well, the reason they got bigger is they were more productive. They were solving consumers' problems better and so on.
Well, that's what I believed, you know, in the mid-90s. And then I put together, at Hamilton Securities, we put together a pool of capital, and we're raising capital to finance groups of small business people in a place, starting venture funds. So, because there's no reason in every neighborhood you can't have the equivalent of a little mutual fund for your neighborhood that is investing in the small businesses and then is issuing a stock which can be traded in a liquid form.
So what did you find by doing that? What did you find out that contradicted this normal perspective?
What I found is if you try and do that, the Department of Justice comes down on your head. I mean, our business was seized by the Department of Justice and shut down.
So are you saying that the big guys get bigger not so much because they were more efficient or more productive, but for other reasons?
Yeah, I think because new technology, new information technology should make the little much more efficient up against the big, not vice versa. But what we saw was that the big could invest tremendous amounts of money in creating, you know, in sort of husbanding the technology to make the big much more competitive with the small. And part of that was government. The big literally using the governmental mechanism to ensure a competitive edge against the small. There are three parts of a business. One is the fundamental business. The other, the second, and in many respects, a very important part is the business of the business. That's the back office, personnel, lobbying, information systems, management sort of development. You need capital to make those investments forward. And corporations have often been very efficient in making those investments forward in a way that small business hasn't. But if you look at the fundamental economics of the technology, small business should be doing a great job at that, and they haven't been. And I think one of the reasons has been there has been tremendous control of who can have access to capital and who can't very much to the advantage of the large corporations, not in any way related to performance, but related to politics.
You said there are three aspects of a business. What was the third?
I'm sorry, financing the business.
Let me ask this. How much of the U.S. economy is spent in trying to keep people down as opposed to expanding the pot?
Well, I would say that the United States federal budget is primarily invested in two things: keeping corporate stocks up in a way that defies fundamental economics, and in keeping a variety of people channeled. You know, sometimes it's controlled, sometimes it's channeled, and resources controlled worldwide. So, for example, worldwide military expenditures, and this is the overt budget, not the total budget, which I think is much higher, but the worldwide military expenditures are now $1 trillion, with the U.S. being almost 50% of that. Now, why does the U.S. need 50%, you know, $500 billion to protect us from the rest of the world, unless you see us as basically being in the business of control and keeping corporate stocks up?
So what you're saying is that the vast majority of economic output is being used unproductively in this country and around the world.
I would say the majority of economic activity is sub-optimized.
So when we see GDP growing, we see employment growing or housing starts growing, these indicators are not telling the real story from your perspective.
They are indicators of activity. They are not indicators of wealth and equity. For example, you can see tremendous growth of activity in a place while the environment and the health of the people is destroyed. So you have no way of measuring the equity. You're simply measuring the activity. And activity can be healthy or not.
So our GDP can be going up while our equity is going down. And in fact, that's been the case.
Right.
And you reflect that with the saying that you have that the Dow Jones is going up and the PopSco index is going down.
Right. Now, I will also say, as you know, Harry, I've spent many years now and hundreds of thousands of miles traveling the country. One of the many reasons I did that was to try and understand what was happening in the economy. And I was convinced when I left Washington in the late 90s that you couldn't understand the economy by looking at the official statistics. I've now reached the conclusion that it is not safe to trust any of the official statistics, as sad to say as that is.
Capital gains, obviously, is a important path to equity growth.
Right.
And to a certain extent, our tax money is going then to boost up the capital gains of a lot of corporations that we then don't have the opportunity to participate in.
Right. One of the chief ideas in the Solari model is how can you create systems, whether around companies or communities, where those who create the equity or preserve the equity, because a lot of it is preservation, enjoy that equity and have a say about that equity. How do you broaden the participation, but in a way that is fundamentally increasingly healthy to the system, because those who are respectful of equity become the stewards of that equity one way or another. And that's very, very important. Where financial equity and financial systems really reflect the underlying assets in the entity that are expressed by that financial equity, the idea of a capital gains really reflects a successful optimization. So it says you're doing something right, whether it's you're using your capital well or you're using the assets well or both, or simply communicating to others how well you're doing and they agree. But to me, capital gains and the ability to create capital gains is really a way to have incentives or share incentives to create something or build wealth for people in very disparate worlds and cultures.
But somehow the capital gains that are being gotten under the current economic system are providing a wrong kind of incentive from your perspective. How did that happen?
Right. Grossly oversimplified, we have stocks, we have liquid stocks, so liquid equity, that reflect functional-based organizations. So we have big multinational corporations, which are, in many respects, place blind, can make tennis shoes anywhere they want. So we're making money on corporate stocks going up, but there's nothing that allows us to see the equity of communities because there are no community stocks outstanding. And so we can't see the stocks of small businesses in a place. We can't see stocks that reflect the value of land in a place. And so when places are raped by large corporations or destroyed by governments who, you know, and large corporations make money, we can see the large corporate stock go up, but we don't see the community stock go down. And worldwide investors and local investors can't make money on the community succeeding. When I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, you know, I would sit in my office and suddenly the home builders and the mortgage bankers and the brokers would all come in lobbying for something. And my staff would say, see, there's a conspiracy. I said, no, there's not a conspiracy. If we change this policy, their stocks are all going to go up. But there was no constituency for the Popsicle Index. There was no constituency that came in and said, look, if you do this, we can get the Popsicle Index up and then I'll make a huge amount of money. Instead, we had this thing called the Dow Jones Index, and there were millions and millions of jobs and millions of resources that organized around that measurement and could make money from that measurement, but there was nothing that would equally incentivize the Popsicle Index. And part of what I realized was, you know, we need a balance here. We need a financial constituency who's for a rising Popsicle Index, or else we're going to get completely overwhelmed. And part of what I really want to stress, Harry, is I know millions of people in my career who say they're for a Popsicle Index, but if you look at their how they deposit their money in banks, if you look at the stocks in their portfolio, if you look at the stocks in the portfolio at their church or university, they say they're for a Popsicle Index, but when you look at how their money works, they're not. They're for making money on destroying places.
Catherine, perhaps a more fundamental problem is that there really isn't a free market. Isn't that, as much as anything, the reason why there's the wrong incentives being generated from capital gains today?
Well, I think, one, we don't have a free market. We certainly don't have a free market for goods and services. We don't have free markets for securities and financial assets and transactions. And we have a currency which is increasingly non-transparent, non-accountable, and really out of control. Now, the absence of that transparency, Harry, can work if you have enough force behind it, both covert and overt. And we've reached the absurd situation where the value of the U.S. dollar is really driven by military and force more than it's driven by
consensus.
Right. So we're looking at something that's supported by fear as opposed to supported by the field. And that's a very bad place to be, because to keep the liquidity going, you have to keep doing things that drive the productivity down. The more you drive the productivity down, the more force you need to keep the thing going. And so you're in a negative loop, and that's what I call the negative return on investment economy.
So there's a key point here that, I mean, you came from a Republican background, a conservative background, and you believe in free markets. You believe,
right.
You believe in capital gains. You believe in the power of money to do good things.
Right. Financial tools are one of the greatest power tools ever created to allow people to invent their world. I mean, I believe we have the power to invent our world. We have a responsibility to invent a beautiful world. If we're going to do that, I mean, certainly an individual can do many things, but if we're going to collaborate and really build very powerful fields that we share across cultures and worlds that allow us to be very different and have different values, but still, you know, get that harmonization that creates that really powerful shared intelligence. Financial tools are essential to do that.
And a market that allows for transactions of integrity to occur and to be honored is a critical part of that.
Right. The challenge has always been, how do you enforce against the player who's willing to damage and shrink the pie for their own benefit? And the way some would say, how do you enforce the rule of law? How do you stop the criminal player from winning?
How do you get the mad dog chained?
Right. And the reality is you can't ultimately create a government that's going to control the mad dog. You need the field to control the mad dog.
Which means individuals taking responsibility?
Right. So individuals have to be prepared to say, I'm not going to play with a mad dog. I don't care how much money the mad dog has. I'm going to shun the mad dog. Now, it's very interesting. There's a great economist, a guy named Axelrod, and what he found, and this is a very important piece to the creation of the Solari model, what he found is in a continuous interaction system, that is where one-night stands weren't possible. So I can't just go far, far away to another place, misbehave, come back, and nobody knows. So we have transparency throughout the whole system, and whatever I do to you, I'm going to run into you next week, and you're going to know not just what I did to you, but what I did to Harry and Sally. So we have a continuous interaction system with transparency. What he found is that the player who was successful is the player who now plays by the rules that I'm going to describe when we get into more detail about how the Solari model works. He called it tit for tat. So the way tit for tat works is I always cooperate unless you misbehave, at which point I whack you. But if you're willing to go back to cooperate, I'm a friendly kind of guy, I go back to cooperating. But I'll never whack first. But if you misbehave, I'll whack. Okay? What he found with tit for tat is the tit for tat often didn't win every battle, but tit for tat always won the war. And the reason tit for tat won the war is, one, tit for tat's behavior was predictable. So players were clear, this is how tit for tat plays. But the other thing is, tit for tat attracted the highest quality players. Tit for tat attracted the people who knew that a sneak cost too much money and a bad dog cost too much money. And so over time, tit for tat attracted the highest quality players, and together they had the highest quality learning speed. So they were much smarter than the guys who played dirty.
I guess that's an incentive for the bad dogs to make things not transparent.
Right.
Because if they're exposed.
Right. And where we've seen.
And if people make the decision that it's more productive, it's a better path to abundance to play by the rules, they're out of the game. But we continue to back the criminal.
Right. Right now, both because of fear and because of ease and comfort, the crowd supports the criminal. And the crowd supports the front man put forward by the criminal. So the crowd continues to say, the Titanic is bigger and stronger. You know, I'm not going to get in an arc. I'm not going to support the arcs. And so I think the single most important thing that keeps a lot of money stuck on the Titanic is that there's a common notion that you got to go with the system, that it's not possible to build outside.
So Solari, to a large extent, is removing the excuse that people have for backing the criminal anymore.
Right. First of all, you've got to look at the criminal. I think one of the challenges, and we talked about this in our audio seminar for Beyond Socially Responsible Investing, part of the practice in the current socially responsible investing is we don't need to look at that. We don't need to know who's being socially irresponsible. We don't need to know where evil comes from. So we can pretend that that doesn't exist, and we can choose all these companies blind to that knowledge. Okay, so that's kind of the monkey, you know, the monkey see.
No see, no hear.
So the first thing we're saying is, no, we need transparency, and we need to look at where evil comes from. We need to look at everything.
Illuminate,
and we need to integrate. We can't say, oh, my values are over here, but where my money goes and what it does is not my business. You know, that's a different thing. It has no connection. Our philosophy is financial intimacy. Where my money goes and what it does, there am I. So it's my human energy going out there. If I'm invested in the Calvert Social Index Fund, and the Calvert Social Index Fund is invested in Halliburton, and Halliburton's over in Iraq killing, then I'm over in Iraq killing. You know, ditto treasury securities, everything else.
This goes to this concept of financial intimacy, right?
Right. Financial intimacy. One of my favorite pastors, T.D. Jakes, says intimacy, into me see. It's a wonderful expression. Financial intimacy basically says I invest with the people that I know and trust, or the people that they know and trust, and in products I know and trust. The idea is, you know, it's what Eldridge Cleaver says, I want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And what that means is, you know, we're looking to diversify, and a large corporation is presumed guilty until proven innocent. This is not the court of law. This is the court of investment. Okay. Investment says, in financial intimacy, where my money goes and what it does, there am I. So I can't put my money someplace where I have reason to believe, you know, that they're not doing something that's part of the solution.
Anonymity is the opposite of accountability, the opposite of illumination, the opposite of what it takes to be intelligent and have a higher learning mechanism. So
right.
We've got to take responsibility.
Right, and part of it gets back to the learning system and creating a new field. I started to help people with sort of thinking through their risks when it came to approaching investment about 2 years ago. And I was stunned, Harry, because what I discovered while I was off dealing with litigation and some of the darker forces of the risk issues, what I discovered is people had really been brought to a place of believing that they couldn't understand the world of investment and they couldn't see it as part of an integrated whole to their life. One of the things I always tell everybody is don't watch the news as a citizen or as a human being and then say, okay, well, I'm going to read these magazines and watch this news for my financial news as though it's separate, as though it's a different world. What I always say is, you know, you should get your information in a way that you can understand the relationship between what your investments or what investments are doing and what the financial markets are doing with how the planet's being governed and what that means to you and your family and your network and your world. It's one world.
Just to review a few themes, we looked at the word Solari, the fundamental goal of Solari, in terms of this concept of harmonization, the importance of illumination. We've beginning to explore the importance of equity and the role of equity, the significance of decentralization versus centralization, this concept of financial intimacy, which you go into in quite detail in another audio seminar.
Right, in Solari Portfolio Strategy, we go into it in great detail and show. And I think this is the most helpful. We walk through $1 million portfolio without financial intimacy, which is very typical of a lot of the portfolios, and $1 million after financial intimacy.
We've looked at the theme of the importance of a free, healthy market as the foundation for wealth, abundance, peace, and productivity, and how, to a certain extent, the tapeworm and the decentralization team has been manipulating that. And then we've touched on this idea of being responsible, and also as money is being kind of a form of energy.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the tapeworm.
Yeah, the tapeworm is my expression for the forces that we're dealing with that are centralizing both political and economic power. You know, some people will call that force the New World Order. Some people will call it the corrupt financial system, but it's basically a system where a handful of insiders benefit at the expense of the outsiders and do it in a way that is very sneaky, very subtle, and it's a constant drain like a tapeworm. And a tapeworm is a parasite that can be quite invisible and quite hard to kind of figure out and find and get out. And one of the ways a tapeworm works, Harry, is it injects a chemical into your system that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm and bad for you. And so this gets back toward the notion we're talking about the crowd supporting the criminal. One of the injections of the tapeworm is corporate media. And corporate media, to me, has done a masterful job of getting folks to kind of buy into the system and keep supporting the system in a way that's not to their advantage. You know, another form of injection from the tapeworm is sort of the philosophies that are propounded by great universities. So we'll see, for example, studies issued by Harvard University talking about why deregulation is great, and then the studies paid for by Enron, and then Enron takes the study and runs around and, you know, knocks on a whole bunch of government officials until they outsource a whole bunch of contracts and on and on and on. So an enormous amount of time and money, including government money, taxpayers' money, is spent on justifying and spinning that which is good for the tapeworm and getting people to believe it. And that's why, you know, one of the things I always say, although it doesn't sound like it follows from the proposal of a financial or investment model, is turn off your TV. If we're going to integrate our world and if we're going to build a new world, we need authentic sources of information. So, again, you know, the creation of the new kinds of fields that can support a new market or new markets, they require authentic flows of information and transparency. Part of transparency is, when I say transparency, I mean transparency of shared money. Part of a healthy information system is also privacy, respect for an individual's privacy. One of my favorite lines is from Nicholas Negroponte, who once said, in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money. And that's absolutely true. One of the problems we have now is the tapeworm knows more about your finances and my finance than we know. They have that much access to what is supposed to be private information. So I think part of a liquid economy, part of healthy transparency, is the ability for individuals to claim a certain amount of privacy of themselves and their data.
Turn off your TV, change your bank to a local bank that's doing good things for your community, and eat fresh.
Eat fresh, because if you can't think, hard to create a field if you can't think. Yeah, so eat fresh food. Who's your banker? Who's your farmer? Where's your money? You know, because you'll see somebody and they'll have their money in Monsanto, who's destroying the food system, in my opinion, and they're making good yields, they're getting good dividends, and they're then taking that money and using it to buy organic food or fresh food, and the food is getting more and more expensive. And I say to them, look, why not take your money, sell the Monsanto stock, invest that money in farmland, in supporting a farmer who'll grow your fresh food. Because if you want fresh food and clean water and clean air, you need to bank it. Otherwise, it might not be there. And I don't mean it might not be there in the system. It might not be there for you. You need to own it. I've been trying to persuade a friend of mine to take money out of the stock market to build a well. Because if he just stops paying his water bill, he will get a better yield on that investment than if he keeps it in the current stock market. So this notion of strategically arranging the resources we need to be healthy as the best investment there is in building equity. Look at the yields. Again, it's all part of this integration of the multiple personality disorder. I think it's really important to not come from a place of fear, but to come from a place of amusement. And the tapeworm is kind of a, you know, it's kind of a funny illusion. But the one thing about a tapeworm that everybody knows, it's something you want to flush. You want to withdraw your energy from the tapeworm. You don't want to feed it.
Catherine, there's a slogan, you might say, that might be appearing soon on your website. Liquefy and make accessible.
To liquefy and make accessible.
Tell us about that.
Well, liquidity, if you go to encyclopedia and you say, what's liquidity? Liquidity will say that there's a critical mass of willing buyers and willing sellers to always make a market at a price which reflects economic value and has low transaction costs. But I would describe liquidity in a more abstract way, because to me, liquidity is more than just financial liquidity. It's liquidity of information and liquidity of spirit. Some people describe market as a place where transactions happen and goods and services get transferred. But I start with a definition of a market as a field. So if you want to build a new world, you have to create a new field. And you have to create a new field which is worthy of the investment, which is in essence intergenerational covenants, leaving the old field and being safe and welcome in the new field. So to me, the way you create a world is the same as you create a market. There's an expression you'll hear on Wall Street about making markets, creating markets, inventing markets. And that's really about creating a field. And liquidity in a field is when you have one of the most important conditions requisite to the low cost, and when I say low cost, I don't just mean money, I mean time, but the low cost sharing of intelligence and the creation of the highest learning speeds. If we look at our situation on planet Earth in terms of scenario design, one scenario is all the capital, whether it's intellectual capital or financial capital, stays inside the tapeworm. And in that model, the way you get to sustainability is you depopulate. That's, if you just do the math, you've got to shrink the population, including it at a possibly dramatic rate, because you have far more pressure on the resources than the current level of resources can take. So you either lower lifestyles, you decrease population, or you radically improve the integration of intelligence and technology into how we do things.
Which is the second option.
So the second option is, instead of depopulating or, you know, destroying the planet, I should say that is an option. The second option is to significantly increase learning metabolism in a way that achieves a sustainable culture, because you use intellectual capital to create the value and technology to create the value that you need. But we're talking about a much more culturally and spiritually advanced civilization than what we have now.
But don't you recognize the physical limits of resources, and isn't that really a constraint despite our intellectual capital?
There is no doubt that there are serious physical constraints to resources, and one of the most important is our time. But what there are not constraints to is the creation and growth of intellectual capital and the application of that intellectual capital to both process and the creation of tools and infrastructure to change dramatically how we use those finite resources.
But folks like the peak oil folks and other folks say that we're going to be constrained greatly by energy. And in order to do the type of recycling that's necessary, because we're also depleting our physical resource base, we're going to need incredible amounts of energy that are going to be increasingly unavailable. What would be your answer to that?
Well, there are two things, and they're both uncertain. One is, in my personal experience, I've watched and researched from people I trust centuries of suppression of advanced technology. The question is, what would happen if that technology was available? And let's say it exists. I can't fathom how it could be available to a civilization that doesn't grow up. In other words, whatever technology is available requires a very different culture and governance process to manage that powerful technology. So, for example, let's say, you know, that the people who say that free energy exists, that would give us the energy we need to then destroy the planet, you know, and destroy all the other resources on the planet at the current lifestyle and way of operating.
A lot of those same people say that it's being constrained right now by, in some instances, a cabal.
Right.
Do you feel that cabal is actually a benevolent cabal that's keeping it to themselves so that people don't use it to destroy themselves? Or do you think that it's more of a malintentioned
cabal? I think there are parts of that cabal which are absolutely not benevolent. So question number one is what is the repressed technology and what could it do? That's number one. Number two, and I think this is more important, if a field was created which was worthy of investment, you know, if a flotilla of arcs became sufficiently viable that the money could shift over, then what you could see happen is a learning speed that is beyond the ability of any of the people talking about peak oil to contemplate. Because then you're talking about the technology and knowledge available to elites merging with the application power and the invention power of the people who are really on the ground.
In the sense of practicality, you might say.
Right, right. And there's far more invention power on the ground, bottom up, than there is in all the fancy and expensive labs of any corporation. But you require a liquid process to communicate that and share the benefits of that. And that's the power of a liquid market.
I want to go back to one point, if I can. If people that are encoding some of this technology would not be classified as worthy, perhaps, in either your book or mine, then why is it the onus of the general population to have to be worthy to have this technology?
Well, I think the worthiness issue comes down to risk, and the risk issue is solved by the field. We've watched thousands of people and thousands of companies try to build a new world, but nothing has come together. In other words, we have a team of people who are centralizing economic and political power, including what you just referred to as the cabal. What we don't have a clear picture of is a new team of people who are envisioning a decentralized world that is a world of peace and a world of abundance, which is safe for the investment capital that's currently in the other world to come and join. What we don't see is the emergence of a network of leaders on a diverse basis and a flotilla of arcs that are worthy of our own capital. Because if you wander around among all the people who are building the new world, they have their 401ks and their investment capital still in the old world. And that's really the test. Now, let's say such a thing were to emerge. If it emerges, there's a process of invention that allows a very dispersed group of people to sort of co-invent something from their own point of view and figure out the risk issues and all the application issues. Once that gets sorted out, then we see something very powerful go up the S-curve, because it's that, I call it swarming. It's that swarm, it's that network invention process that really works out the complexity and the risk issues and then takes it up what some people call the non-local transfer. It's what takes this something from 6 monkeys to 100 monkeys. Let's call them the living network team. The living network team has never swarmed a picture of a new world that could pass that test and then skip up the S-curve. And so that's what we're trying to build towards. And my contention is when you see a learning metabolism kick up that high on an open basis, then you get 6 billion people inventing solutions, and it can go much faster than anybody dreams.
You're optimistic that the living network team is going to win?
I'm optimistic that they can win. And I'm optimistic that there's nothing I see that says it's impossible. The notion that it's hopeless, to me, is the most ridiculous thing in the world. Now, that doesn't mean that they will win. And to me, the critical issue is, will they create a investment construct which is sufficient for the money to leave the tapeworm? Think of the money right now as the blood. Is it engorging the tapeworm, or is it building a healthy new world? And right now, the test is, where is our money? And again, if you go to a peace march, if you go to a conference on peak oil, if you go to all these places, or just wander around a community that says they're interested in reviving their community, you know, whether it's the endowment at the university, grandma's 401k, the money at the church, the school board just did a bond issue, where are they investing the money? All that money is channeling back into the tapeworm. And so the issue is, how do we bring it over? And then how do we bring it over in a way which is worthy of that money?
Right. So you've basically gone to the heart of the theme of the role of the individual, the importance of being responsible, being worthy, and concept of financial stewardship, too, and this whole theme of basically, are we going to be free or are we going to be slaves? And, of course, very closely related to all this is the process of coming clean.
Right. Right. Well, as I said, when I started Hamilton in Washington, the question was, let's prototype what this new world looks like for an individual, for a community, and for an enterprise. Because an investment model has to work for all the different types of organizations and types of people and places. So one of the things that came out was, of course, it starts with the individual who has to take responsibility to say, I have the power to invent my world. And part of that power of inventing my world is coming clean, because we can't solve, you know, it's what Einstein said, you can't solve a problem with the mentality that created it. So you can't shift and build a new world if your head is still inside the tapeworm or approaching things in that way. So issue number one is, how do I come clean? And part of coming clean is letting go of the connection, letting go of the addiction to corporate TV, letting go of the addiction to all those kinds of foods and lifestyle and whatever.
And changing your local bank.
Changing your, but then coming clean with your money. So now it's interesting. I remember when I realized all of this coming clean thing. And so I said, okay, well, you know, if this makes sense, then I've got to do it myself. And I'll do it myself and I'll see what happens. And I started to do it because, you know, looking at the whole system, that was one of the component parts of what we had to do to build a new world. I'm a prototyper. So like Madame Curie, I'll take the radium. So I start to come clean. And it took me about, it was a year or two. And then suddenly I woke up one day and I realized I had far fewer problems in my life than my friends. And the reason was I had several degrees of separation between me and the tapeworm. I had an intimate relationship with all the different people I was doing business with day to day to day to day to day. And if I had a special need or I had a problem, I could go to them and we had a relationship and everything worked. And they weren't always angry and mad the way people, you know, the people who are stuck in the tapeworm. And so I started to realize, you know, I have a wonderful life. And it started to change my notions of what excellence is. Because the most important thing in building a new investment model is we always go for that which is excellent. But you really want to do this in a way where you're focusing on associating with the people and the products and services which you believe to be excellent. But for me, excellent became not do they have the fanciest, spiffiest office, but excellence is, in the worst case, are they there for me in a friendly, wonderful way? You know, I started to come clean because it was what made sense system-wide. I kept coming clean because it was much more fun. Life improved. And I was really diversifying and moving out of the tapeworm into a whole new world, which was a superior world.